Welcome, everybody. My name is Matt Harris. I'll be the moderator today. Just a couple opening remarks here, and if you don't mind, I'm going to actually get a little personal to begin with, just to kind of bring the room together. It's been true since I was a kid that I always wished to be seen as sort of a little edgier than I might appear, a little more dangerous, a little crazy, and I've never been successful at that, not even the slightest bit. To the point where I was sort of beginning to capitulate on this ever happening for me. Coming down to South by Southwest, I thought was maybe my last hope. And then I realized that I'm out on a panel about regulation. So I think that last inch of a dream has just been snatched from me right here, particularly when you think about the fact that my job actually is the moderator. So like as if there was a risk that these people talking about regulation were going to become immoderate in any way, I'm here to make sure that doesn't happen. So it's this inner turmoil that caused me, after consulting with my fellow panelists, to introduce a special mechanism here on our panel to make sure things don't get too boring. So we went ahead and procured a bottle of tequila, which we're going to put in this ice, and a stack of shot glasses. So we're brainstorming what are the conventional sins of panels. We came up with two. The first is when the panelists all agree with each other or do other things generally accepted to be boring. And the second is when people in the audience get up to purportedly ask a question and go on to make a 5-minute comment, typically one that's touting their own company. So if either of those things happen, it involves a shot of tequila for the offender. And I've made myself the arbiter of the offense. Compliance will be a lot easier for the panelists. I can just reach over and make sure they comply. I don't want to have to come into the audience to get one of you guys. So let's all just tacitly, silence implying consent, agree to these ground rules and be judged accordingly. So we're going to talk about, in fact, not regulation and regulators. We're going to talk about how innovators attack regulated industries and particularly attack regulated incumbents here today. So we've got four such innovators. I run a venture capital firm called Village Ventures. I'm actually transitioning to take over the New York office of Bain Capital Ventures, but regardless, what I do is back companies in financial services. So for the past dozen years, I've been backing these innovators and seeing them and helping them struggle, sometimes succeed, sometimes fail, against both their competitors, but also an entrenched bureaucracy. So that's our topic today. With the ground rules established, I'm going to ask my fellow panelists to introduce themselves for 3 or 4 minutes. We're going to run into some questions and then turn it over to you all about halfway through. Jessica.
Thanks, Matt. Hi, everyone. My name's Jessica Scorpio. I'm one of the founders of GetAround. GetAround is a marketplace for peer-to-peer car sharing. We enable car owners to share their car when they're not using it and for people to get access to a car when they need one. We provide the insurance, we facilitate the financial transaction, and we also do driver record checks to the individuals. So there's about 10 things on my list that we've had to bump up against in terms of regulation to get this off the ground. Essentially, we founded the company to solve a problem that we call car overpopulation. There's 1 billion cars on the planet that sit idle any given time, and they actually sit idle 92% of the time. So that's a pretty crazy stat, and we found out that it was going to double to 2 billion cars in the next 20 years. We thought this was a really, really ineffective system. It's something that pollutes our roads, it congests our cities, and it's really expensive. All of you who own a car here probably spend about $8,000 a year owning and maintaining a car that sits idle. So now you have another option. But this dream really took a lot of work to get to market, and even so, we are rolling out city by city because it's so complicated to get right. So I'm going to tell you all about that today. The main industries that we bump up against are car rental, automotive, and the insurance industry. As well, we build our own hardware, so we also have to go through electronic certification and all that jazz. In terms of my background, I founded a non-for-profit startup before GetAround called Ideal, which worked to connect young leaders with experts in their field. And I also, my main two areas are politics and marketing. So I worked for the Prime Minister of Canada for a number of years doing public policy and also communications. And most recently, I graduated from Singularity University, which is where we came up with the idea for GetAround. I look forward to joining this awesome lineup of panelists.
Cool. Hi, everybody. Adam Oliveri from Second Market. I was one of the early employees at Second Market when we started in 2005. We are a marketplace for alternative assets, and alternative assets, as we define them, are things that sort of aren't traditionally traded or listed on public exchanges. So our goal is to basically be able to facilitate transactions in weird securities for people that own them and people that want to buy them. We're most well known for doing that in the space of venture-backed private technology companies. So in 2007, we got a phone call from a former employee of Facebook, and they said, hey, I'm not here anymore. I'm not at Facebook anymore. I'd just like to go ahead and sell some of my stock. You guys have a platform for trading weird securities. Can you help me out? So we did, and that really transformed our business pretty dramatically. It really became our principal business over the last few years. So what we do today is we provide a platform to private companies to go ahead and create liquidity programs for their shareholders as private companies. So staying outside of the public market regulation and sticking with the private company regulation, but still being able to facilitate securities transactions in a compliant way. So we're regulated in a lot of different ways. We're regulated by all the major securities regulations that have been out there, the 33 Act and the 34 Act, and I could go on and on, but we're regulated as a broker-dealer. So that's the principal kind of method through which we interface with the regulatory bodies. And that's really the only one we run into is the securities industry regulation. So turn it over.
Hey guys, Azar Askin. Massive Health is my company. Previously was at Firefox. Our goal is to go create a design renaissance in healthcare, because there's a reason why you've never heard pleasurable and health product in the same sentence until this one. The best way I can describe this is, actually, how many of you remember what a VCR is? And now how many of you can program it? Yeah, this is South By. So for those you can't, when you look at a VCR, is it your fault you can't program it? Or is it the guy that designed that you can't program it? Right? Obviously, we're all here, we all know this, it's the guy that designed the VCR's fault. So, 22% of Americans don't finish their antibiotics course. That creates super viri. We spent hundreds of millions of dollars with PSAs trying to get people to finish the antibiotics course, but they start feeling fine, therefore they must be fine, so they don't. So here's the question. If one out of five people don't finish their antibiotics course, and we spent so much time and energy trying to educate them, is it people's fault, or is it the design of our intervention's fault? I think, put it that way, it's really obvious. It's the design of our intervention's fault, because our medical products should work the way we do. And this is exactly where we start running into the regulated industry problem, because to change these things as simple as pills, and that's not necessarily the kinds of things we start out with, all of a sudden you're trying to be matched against something which is pre-existing. You don't want to change the status quo, and the ways that they even think about regulating don't match with the ways that people work, and that's the problems that we have.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shamir Karkal, co-founder of Simple. We used to be called Bank Simple till a few months ago. How many of you have heard of Simple or Bank Simple? That's great. For those of you who haven't, we're basically redesigning the retail banking experience. We do that by building online experiences, mobile apps, having no hidden fees, and with great customer service. The idea for Simple was actually born a couple of years ago when my co-founder Josh, who's sitting over there in the corner, sent me an email saying, let's start a retail bank. At the time, I was working as a consultant, and I was more familiar with shutting down banks than starting them. So I was a bit surprised, and I was like, what's gotten into Josh? It was basically born from his frustration with the banking system, which I think a lot of you can relate with. Clearly, banking in the U.S. is broken, and we're fixing it.
Great. Shamir, I'm going to start by picking on you. This is a memory that you and I probably share, which is that I'm an investor in Simple, and a fellow investor is a guy named Josh Koppelman at First Round Capital, great guy, who's also an investor in a company called Uber, which I don't know if you've heard of it. Actually, show of hands, who's heard of Uber? Very big number. One of the main reasons people learned about Uber was they were sued by the Taxi and Limousine Commission in San Francisco. And we were in a board meeting basically when that happened. And we were having a conversation about Simple, than BankSimple in our stance vis-a-vis regulators. And it was a really instructive data point that showed that confrontation isn't all bad. Sometimes confrontation, as in the case of Uber, was transformative to the good. So, Shamir, I'd like to, you to take that point on, which is when faced with regulation that limits your desired activities, talk about the pros and cons of fight it versus comply with it.
Matt, as you're well aware, we have faced that problem many times together. So
heard something about that, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's one of those make or break decisions which all companies in these sorts of industries face. When you have something like that happen to you and you're butting heads with some form of regulatory authority, whether it's state, city, federal, whatever it is, the moment you butt up against it and take that fight on, you're going to have a huge amount of publicity, and you will also have a huge amount of support from people such as yourselves. So that can actually be transformative and make the company viral and much larger. On the other hand, the risk that you face is those are authorities, and they can actually just shut you down for periods of up to years at a time, right? And as a startup, you don't always have the luxury of waiting 2 years for the regulation to be changed or somebody to come to their senses. The best example of this is that when Josh and I first talked about this, we wanted to get our own bank charter until we started the process of applying for a charter and were told that it would take us about 5 years before we could actually get our first customer. And we just decided 5 years is way too long. We can't wait that long, so we'll have to find a different way. And the way we did was to actually partner with existing banks so that we act as a front end to their depository capabilities. And that's worked pretty well for us, but it's still taken us about 2 years to get there. So it is a big risk, and it has sort of a, you know, it's high risk, high reward, right? If it makes you big, you will explode like Uber. If you fail, I don't know how many other startups out there are, you know, derelict because they bumped up against the wrong authority.
It's important to note that this is exactly why startups can work in this space and not the sort of entrenched players, because our risk profile is much better. We can take much bigger risks because if we fail, our company dies. We don't have, you know, billions of dollars that are already invested in us.
Yeah. There's one important point, though, and it's who's taking the risk. Because in Uber's case, they were taking the risk, and the fines and the punishment would come on the leadership and the company. So for us, we actually chose to take a more traditional route in getting regulations changed and laws passed before launching to market. So for Get Around, the decision was basically, do we go with insurance or without insurance? And we felt like for people to be willing to share their cars with strangers, insurance needs to be provided. But for that to happen, it was a very long road. It was also about a year and a half. And we said, you know, we're not going to have our customers take those risks because they have the problem of facing, you know, their car insurance being canceled and having issues come upon themselves. So if people, you know, using Simple or riding in Ubers could face prison time or something, you know, that's, you have to weigh the who it's impacting. I think that's important to note. And also what options you have. I want to, throughout this discussion, promote real good solutions that you can try and do if you want to go into a regulated industry. Because I think some of the most innovative and disruptive ideas are coming into regulated industries.
Yeah. I think the point of who actually takes the risk is hugely important. One of the things I tell all our employees is that under the USA Patriot Act, unknowing failure to comply can lead to a $200,000 fine, and a willful failure to comply can lead to a $500,000 fine and up to 7 years in jail. And the people who get sent to jail are not the front line, it's usually the executives of the company.
It's not the venture capitalists, right?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good.
The FDIC usually goes after the executives.
So one of the models I have in my head as I look at solutions in this space is actually the Safe Harbor Act, where, you know, everyone probably knows this already, but if you have copyrighted material up on your website, it's user-generated, it's not your fault, it's the user's fault, and you have to go take it down, and maybe all the chilling effects of that notwithstanding, it has let user-generated content sites flourish. And I look for similar things in our space. So say in medicine, while I'm not allowed to give you medical advice, if I present your information in a way which is privacy preserving to your peers or to other people like you or to your friends, they can give you medical advice because that's just friends talking and people talking. And so in that sense, you're taking the risk off of you and pushing it onto other people, and now it becomes an interface problem of how do we get other people to give you good advice? And so that's sort of my equivalent of the safe harbor of medicine.
Aza, let me jump in there because you're actually disagreeing with Jessica. Jessica was saying she didn't want to put any of her users or customers at any risk. It sounds like what you're saying is we want to make sure the company's not at any risk, but if people want to give each other medical advice, go straight ahead. Does that feel like the way medical advice should be distributed?
So this is one of those interesting places where absolutely you want to give people the very best medical advice, but you have to be very creative around the rules and regulations that already exist. What's different with the get-around model is that your insurance when your car crashes, I don't know all the details, of course, is probably very different than when somebody gives somebody else some advice. Because you're giving advice, that's no risk to the person. They're not a medical professional, and there's no representation that this device is telling you something that you should do, which you haven't followed. So it's different. We take the risk and we push it off into this world, and it actually sort of disappears into the ether of vagary.
I think you're actually talking about loopholes. So where ways you can start your innovative, disruptive business in a loophole till you get to the point where you can be really, really above board.
I think you mispronounced it, opportunity.
He's suggesting you mispronounce opportunity as loophole.
Yes.
Okay. Options.
No, but I think it's a very good point that most of those loopholes are what we all use to sort of get ahead and get around some
Sometimes
of these painful
the loophole,
regulations.
Though, doesn't have to be so much of a loophole. I mean, you can participate in the process, in the regulatory process, in a nominal way. You can find sort of a creative, nominal way to participate. And that's what we did. Before we launched, we became a regulated broker-dealer in 2005. And so, you know, we were part of the regulatory process, and that kind of, we didn't know that this was going to be the case, but when we went and sat in the room with the regulators, and their way of regulating was like, send us some checklists and we'll come in every once in a while and like look at those checklists and talk to you about what you do, we realized that they had no idea what was going on. They had no staff, they had no people, they had no way to understand any of this activity. So it was actually a good thing that we participated in this process, because we participated in a process that's really, really broken to our benefit. And we're able to kind of innovate and iterate and keep moving until we got to a place where our customers really, really loved our product. And then we have something of like a shield there, because we have the, you know, laws are sort of statements of intent, in my belief. And so when you have a bunch of people out there saying, we intend to use this product because it gives us some really awesome and valuable service, then those laws will start to come into your favor over time. So that's kind of one. It's not a loophole. It's you know, actually taking a step into the regulatory process, but in a way that can practically benefit you. My advice would be, you know, try actually sort of strategize and seek it out beforehand. We just kind of said, well, there's no other way to do it. There probably were many other ways that we could have done it, so we got lucky. And I would encourage you not to just rely on luck in terms of participating in a regulated industry.
There's an interesting point there as well, which is often when you think about this, and the way we sort of started talking about it is, it's an us versus them mentality. It's us versus the regulators because they're evil, and that's actually not the case. They're normal people. You get to know them. They're trying to do a job. They're understaffed and underserved, and they don't really understand everything that's going on. And to the extent that you can go in, this is certainly true at the FDA, that they're trying to keep people safe and trying to make sure people have the medicines that they need. So a great example of this that the FDA came up with, and I can't remember how many tens of years ago it was, with this thing called orphan drugs, which is an intentional loophole that they built in, where your drug, if it affects fewer than, I can't remember, like 5,000 people, and then I think it's 20,000 people, I can't remember the exact numbers, doesn't have to go through the same regulatory process because it just affects smaller number of people. And if you did have to go through that regulatory process, your drug would never be economical in terms of coming out. And so there are ways of working with them, because in the end, their goal is generally not to stop innovation, but to make sure that people are kept safe.
Yeah, but there's a big risk there. I mean, if you actually do engage with the regulators early on, before you have sort of market validation, you run the risk that, you know, they're not bad people, they just don't live in the world that we do. And they might easily say, yeah, let's figure that out, and till then stay on hold. And even that's not actually a bad situation, but that means that if your product launch is delayed by 6 months, that might be the end for a small company, right?
Yeah.
So even just the, you know, there's real risks to engaging mm-hmm. with the regulators, which you shouldn't sort of downplay either.
Yeah. No.
That's a really key point, because there's a right time to approach government and regulators, and if you approach them and they get scared off and then put regulations specifically against your company or the space you're trying to go into, that's going to be a major problem. So the key point I was going to make about, you know, interfacing with government that I think hits what we're all talking about is using their terminology in classification. So if you can show them that you fit into something that they understand, they're going to give you that stamp of approval. It's really, really ironic, but when we're talking about car sharing, and we really think it's real car sharing because it's enabling people to share cars, we have to say, oh, this is car rental. This is this and this and this. And they're like, oh, yes, we know that. And for us, we actually run the risk of down the road, we may get taxed and have to fight, you know, car rental tax because we've used some of that terminology, A, because people understand it, and B, regulatory environment understands that and allows car rental. So I think it's a balance of, you know, using their terminology, going through the application process you can, but it's harder to, you know, our policy is ask for forgiveness, beg for forgiveness, not go forward and say, hey, am I allowed to do this? Because if you do that, there is a lot of risk that you could get banned.
Let me just ask about that, because you have a reputation as somebody who actually got a law changed in California. So that strikes me as an example of you actually a priori decided you had to. Has anyone else here gotten a law or regulation changed to your benefit?
We're getting there.
You're getting there? I mean, it's a big deal. So can you talk about, why did you choose to do that instead of this ask for forgiveness strategy, which is more generally, I think, what startups do, and B, how did you do that? Is that a reasonable thing that people should think about as a plan?
Yeah. That's a really good question.
Thank you.
Basically,
you have to do a shot for saying it was a good question. We call that pandering, Jessica.
There's no salt.
That's a really good question. It's one of those things that's clearly just about stalling. I think we should just call it what it is. It wasn't that great a question. It's right here on my list.
All right.
Carry on.
Getting a law passes on my list, too. Basically, we approached every insurance company and executive in the continental U.S. and probably North America, and everyone said, no, we won't insure you. So in trying to get insurance, which we already explained is really key to launching this new model, we thought, okay, what else can we try? And we tried cold calling VPs. We tried, you know, showing up at people's office. We tried hundreds of different, you know, contacts and brokers. And so the other thing we had on our list, just because my background's in politics and kind of lobbying public policy, was, oh, right, why don't we try and get a law passed? Maybe that'll help. We literally were just trying to be as exhaustive as possible because it seemed so impossible. And what we did to get the law passed was essentially to partner up with people that had existed for a long time. So car sharing companies that had a track record and were big names and had a customer base and insurance experience. And so the main one was City Car Share, which is a big non-for-profit car sharing company in San Francisco. And so we got them to work with us and to lobby the state legislature to have a car sharing law. And because they were saying, this is time, the country needs this, the state needs this, this is good for cities and municipalities, we were able to, you know, get it done. And to my point about asking for forgiveness, now what we are able to do, because we've done that in three states, California, Oregon, and Washington, and we're dealing with legislative calendars, i.e. they don't sit every year, we're still pushing that forward in every state we want to operate in as a consumer confidence piece. But now we have that credibility. Now we can point to, oh, all the states on the West have approved this. We do that so that it's not a gray area, but it's not, the legislation is not required to actually operate. So it's more of a nice to have than a necessity. But for us, the law in the first place, and this is back in 2010, was the piece that kind of tipped the scale. So once we got that, we were halfway down the road negotiating the insurance contract, and then we basically hooked Berkshire Hathaway to be our insurance partner.
Nice. And so give me some sense, give us some sense of the time frame. If you hadn't had to do this, how many months or quarters could you have saved in your go-to-market?
A year.
A full year?
At least a year, yeah.
And how many millions of dollars, or I mean, how many people did you have?
Oh, no, we were super lean. Basically, we were developing our technology. And we knew that had a timeline and that had a regulatory aspect as well. So we're pushing both forward in parallel.
Oh, that's great. I want to ask about another facet of this, which is competition with other startups in regulated industries. So we've seen various tactics of collaborating. You collaborated with a nonprofit, which is interesting in that there are for-profit venture-backed startups trying to do the same thing. Have people tried that with any success, partnering with your peers as sort of a collective, A? And B, in your instance where you chose not to, do you feel like you paved...
They didn't exist.
So you were just early.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you paved a road for others to come compete with you? And I'd love you to characterize that frustration. So first question, has anyone else done this, you know, or done the opposite? And this notion of being the guy getting the arrows in the back so that others can be more successful coming after you, how do you think about that?
We certainly join consortiums. When you look at how you're supposed to develop software in the medical industry, it can be fairly egregious. While it isn't exactly legislated that you have to use Waterfall, that's what they assume you're going to be using. So when you try to use anything else, whether it's Agile, Scrum, or Lean, or any of these things, they just look at you funny, and it makes your life much, much, much harder. So we've certainly spent time grouping with other people and trying to get our voices heard, replete with going and testifying for the FDA. Not much happened with that, unsurprisingly, but because probably their decision-making processes use Waterfall. That's about as far as we've gone.
Yeah. One example from my experience is in the peer-to-peer lending space. I don't know if people are familiar with Prosper and Lending Club, or the two big U.S. peer-to-peer consumer lending businesses, and they took very different tacks. Prosper basically told the government, you know, we're going to do what we're going to do, and we don't think this needs to be regulated, and we're halted by the government. Lending Club decided to deal with the SEC, fully register, and create financial products. They spent $10 million to do that. Prosper then changed tack, followed Lending Club, and spent about a third as much because Lending Club had broken the waves for them. So I don't know who was right, but it was a really interesting tango of, you know, who was going to go first in terms of spending the time and legal dollars to define a path.
Yeah. Stuffy, we have a competitor called SharesPost, and they opted not to go down the regulatory path at the beginning, so they went out and just operated the platform as what's called a passive bulletin board, meaning it was just kind of like connecting people. It's sort of Aza's idea of just people connecting to other people to do securities transactions. There were a lot of things that we couldn't do because we were regulated that they could do because they weren't, which was absurd. For example, a shareholder who was using their system could post their securities and then they would tweet out that those securities had been posted on the site, which is, you know, a general solicitation in all likelihood, but because they were just a connecting platform, they didn't make it their concern. It's definitely the shareholder's concern, and so even if we were allowed to have that happen, we probably wouldn't have had it happen. Nonetheless, it existed. So, and there were a bunch of other things that we just had to be more conservative with, and so now, you know, we're getting like no action letters, we're getting legislation passed, we're part of the Jobs Act that passed, I think it was yesterday in the House, had a shareholder bill that increases the number of shareholders that a private company can have to like 1,000 and exempts out employees, which was really driven by Second Market's efforts. And so everybody else will be able to participate in that too. I guess my opinion is that, you know, if you're able to delight your customers while simultaneously participating in the regulatory process and trying to comply as best you can, then great. But if you can't, like if you're at a product disadvantage and it's material, then you have to go the other direction. Like you've got to think about your customers first and the regulators second.
Yeah, there is a little bit of like a first mover disadvantage almost, because you end up fighting all the big battles, and anybody else who comes after you knows exactly what you did and knows that worked, and so can easily shave off as much as 6, sometimes 12 months off the time it took you to get to market, right? We have definitely seen a little bit of that as well with competitors now who are trying to imitate what we are doing. And I mean, for us at least, it's an industry which is large enough that everybody here could succeed wildly, and there's still enough for everybody. So we don't really worry about it.
To the direct question, we collaborated with people in our exact space multiple times to do what we're doing, and we've also, you know, paid up a bunch of money to lobby very early on and work on this when, you know, it does pave the way for competitors to come in and have the easy road. But we think it's worth it because when we're going up against insurance companies, automotive industry, and the car rental industry, people with really deep pockets, you want to pay a few thousand or tens of thousands of dollars to get a law passed rather than have, you know, your business risk getting shut down in a year or two time. So for us, a couple examples, we've worked with Zipcar actually in DC on the federal level to basically educate lawmakers about the benefits of car sharing, and we pitched them on, you know, no one else has ever done this in DC, so why don't you use us as a story of an example of car sharing 2.0 and the next step that can bring car sharing to new areas. So having the savvy to give them the talking points is really, really helpful. And then as we're going state by state right now getting laws passed, we do work with the other peer-to-peer car sharing companies, and in a lot of ways we have to shepherd them, but we come as a united block saying that this is what our industry needs to come to your state. So if you want this, which all your citizens are asking for, you know, this is what we need. And we have to do a lot of negotiation behind the scenes to be a united front, but it would be extremely detrimental if, you know, three companies testify in front of the House of a state and they're giving conflicting information.
So I'm going to ask Shamir to do a shot now. This isn't technically a rules violation on this panel, but something he did that irritated me a few months ago. And I'll tell you the story, which is that... you know, I've been running a venture capital fund, and it means I have to go raise money from various sources, one of whom, a few of whom are banks, and one of those banks I was meeting with, this is 4 or 5 months ago, and I was talking about the portfolio, you know, bragging about the great companies we have, and I mentioned Simple, and the guy across the table said, oh yeah, they're the company on the website where it says that banks suck, right? So you have to do a shot for that, and the money I failed to raise from that guy for backing a company that said that he sucked. But it raises an interesting question, which is, where do you straddle the line between demonizing the incumbents? I mean, regulated industries are, by definition, regulated by the government. They're also characterized often by high levels of concentration, because managing regulation takes scale, and so you end up with scale players. So in banking and insurance, securities dealing, and in healthcare, perhaps least in healthcare, at least in terms of service delivery, but these are still very industries characterized by big, big companies. So, Shamir, I know your strategy, but how do the rest of you sort of walk that line between, you know, Hertz is the devil, we're here to solve the problem, versus, hey, let's all get along, we happen to be more innovative. Why don't I ask you first, Jessica?
Sure. Yeah, so I'll address car rental in a second, but with insurance companies, we're extremely proactive in telling our story and asking them to work with us. We don't have an official partnership program yet, but it's really important to us that if a customer calls their insurance company and says, hey, you name your insurance company, I want to do this thing, what happens to my insurance coverage? We'd like them to be knowledgeable and answer, oh yes, Getaround is okay, approved, go forward, rather than, and this is really difficult because there's tens of hundreds of thousands of insurance people on the phone, but generally, you know, and it's actually helped us a lot with the insurance lobbies getting laws passed because we have been proactive in reaching out to them and spending time with them and, you know, listening to what their concerns are as well. We've gotten them to stop blocking things that could have really screwed us up. So that's insurance. With automotive, luckily the automotive, any car maker, a lot of them are very, very forward thinking right now, especially the European and German ones. So they know that car sharing is a gold mine and they're all trying to get into it. So that's interesting because 2 years ago, you know, they weren't interested. Every sort of company we reached out to said, no way, we're not willing to even put $5 onto the car cost, so we don't even want to take something that's free from you. that doesn't really make sense, but that's what they said. So basically, they all see value in what we're doing, and they want to work with us in some way, shape, or form. So generally, we're very proactive in having discussions. With car rental, I think we're still, they know about us, but we're not specifically working with them. But in a lot of ways, we're, well, we do directly eat into their business, so they should be concerned.
Any other thoughts on this sort of, are they the devil, are they a friend?
Well, so Matt, now that you made me drink that shot, I feel I need to talk about that. So it's not like we you know, we picked banks suck as a marketing slogan because it sounded good, right? I mean, one of the first things Josh and I did when we were when we started up was we put up a sign-up list, and every single person who signed up on the list, we actually sent them a personal email where we didn't automate it. We'd Google the email, find out who the person was, and actually write a two-line email to them asking them. And the amount of feedback we got was amazing. And to synthesize all of that into one slogan, that's where we came up with Banks Suck. Right? That's,
it was thoroughly researched.
It was. I have probably 15,000 emails which can back that up in multiple different ways. So it's a fact of life that at least in this industry, the incumbents have gotten so far out of touch that it with their customers that the startup needs to tell them what their customers think of them, right? I'll give you another anecdote. I was actually asked to do a presentation to the chairman of a top 20 global bank a couple of months ago, right? And I speak to all the bankers. I have a policy of any banker who wants to talk to me, I'm always happy to talk to them. And at the end of the presentation, one of their ventures guys asked me, so why are you presenting this? Don't we compete with you? Aren't you scared of, we'll steal your ideas? I'm like, I could give you my entire code base and you couldn't replicate this, right? What makes us special is not our software. It's the fact that if Josh has an idea or I have an idea, we can go talk to an engineer and it's on the website in a max of 6 weeks, usually about two, right? While for your institution, you can do your best, but nothing is going to change on the website for like 2 years, starting from today. So that, it's not just about the regulation, it's also about the processes and the size of these organizations, which makes which makes them what they are.
Yeah, there's no sustained competitive advantage to product, there's only sustained competitive advantage to innovation.
Exactly.
So on our side, we try to focus more on the problems that we solve rather than who currently does it really poorly. That said, one of the things, and we'll keep this just between you and me. one of the things that really scared me as I started getting going was doing a shadow at the Stanford Clinic. And I was following around for a day, just learning what people did, and I was watching this woman give a diagnosis to a person of being diabetic. For the first time, he'd have to start taking insulin. This is sort of a heart-shattering moment to watch, especially as he kept looking at me, because I was wearing a frock, and asking me questions, and like, I'm not a doctor. Don't do what I say, you're just going to die. But the doctor kept making me answer them, and I was sweating. So here this person was, very confused about the whole process, about to start taking shots of insulin, and if she takes too much, he will quite literally die. And their instruction was, just take it when your numbers are too high. They hadn't really explained what that was yet. They never did. And don't do too much. He's like, what happens if I do too much? And she's like, call this number. We're normally around until around 5 p.m. Yeah. So doctors, and while this doctor was incredibly smart, the incentives aren't always aligned with, say, their patients. And the thing that really disturbed me was when I'm thinking about hiring designers or engineers, I know that they're going to appear on a Gaussian. And the kinds of people that I really want to work with are like over here on the Gaussian, because those are the really smart ones. And there are probably a whole bunch of really terrible engineers who end up working at banks, Java. But that's also true of doctors. And that's the thing that really scared me, that most of these doctors over here, I don't want working on me. So we want to make tools that doesn't antagonize them. We don't ever want to talk about antagonizing them, but we do want to make tools that help them make better decisions without telling them that that's going to happen. So that's a lot of the line that we play with. And in there, it really is just about words and wordsmithing. because you can say the same thing and it can suck, or you can say the same thing and it can be positive. Some things make you drink, and some things, I guess, well, I won't say anything yet.
Let's turn the mic on, if I could ask one of my colleagues here, in case anyone has, it looks like we have a question right off the bat. Be careful.
Did you give Harry the bottle?
Yeah. We need an extra volunteer for the tequila pouring.
All right. I'm Andrew from North Carolina. And, so first part is I want a shot of tequila, so I'm going to take a little bit of time. But, here's the question. What do you do when you're dealing with regulation that fundamentally changes your business? So I built a food truck mapper. Municipalities, you know, food trucks are needed in municipalities, so there are regulations and whatnot. You know, they have to be regulated because they serve food. So we went out and tried to get them access to a downtown city. Now, with the food truck mapper, it helps that they bounce around. But while changing regulation, we kind of encourage the food trucks to stay in one central location. How do you kind of look at the consequences of regulation changes and the implications that has on your business, if that makes sense?
So I'm going to tackle the dynamic nature of regulation and how you manage it while this gentleman does his shot.
Sure. So one of the biggest laws that was passed in the last 2 years was the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010. And it made a huge difference to the financial services industry, and it ended up not making a huge impact on us, but there was a period of about 4 to 6 weeks where we were like, I have no clue what this is going to do to my business model, and I might have to rewrite my business plan once I know what actually gets passed. And in the end, it actually ended up being, on balance, probably helpful. But it's just a risk that you live with. And in this industry, at least in our industry, regulation always affects your business. I mean, it's an intrinsic part.
One of the dangers of like not participating in the regulatory process, if you take that route, would be that you find out about that stuff way too late. So, you know, that we participate in the process, we know about it, we influence it as it's happening. And I think that's the only thing you can do. I mean, if you don't know about it and it passes, then what are you going to do?
Yeah. You also can't know about everything, though, and you have to accept that. Try and be in the know as much as possible, but there's regulations happening federal level, state level, internationally, depending on how you're trying to operate your business. The one thing I kind of thought of when you were asking your question is this horrible word, compliance. And obviously, there's going to be ways you have to, you know, comply with certain regulation you get passed. Ideally, you have an impact on how that's written and how easy it is for you to comply and be part of the process. So that's all we try to do when we're getting laws.
But also look at the robustness of your business model is important here too, because in some ways, to answer your question, it's very similar to answering the question, how does your company deal with new startups getting involved? And you're like, well, I can't really answer that question because it's a big space. But depending on your strategy and how robust it is, sometimes it doesn't even matter. So there's an example, actually I just learned this from one of my biz guy, Andrew, who's over there, where in the Charlotte School District, there is a big problem that the science books weren't very science-y. And they wanted to solve that problem, but there are a whole bunch of laws around changing textbooks. Just can't do it, it takes a long time, then you have to go get new textbooks, and it's going to take far too long. And so their solution is like, well, textbooks are hard, so we're just going to partner with Discover and do like an online thing, and we're not even going to use textbooks. And because they did that, like no amount of change in the textbook industry is going to affect the kinds of learning they do. And then you go look at Khan Academy or TED, who's now getting into education, and all of these ways are a new way of solving the real problem by reframing the problem that they're asking in the first place. In that sense, it's another wishy-washy answer, I know, but it's a way of getting around some of the inherent volatility in regulatory markets.
And you, friend, will do a shot for another wishy-washy answer.
Even for calling it out?
Self-indictment is the easiest path to doing a shot on this panel. Next question.
So startups are sort of characterized by innovation, and not a lot of regulators tweet me. But most regulators are completely not innovative. Sorry, I'm just looking at someone. One thing we talk about around the office.
Sir, you have a relatively thick accent. Could you speak more clearly, please?
Sure. I think I might need a shot for this.
This is Josh from Simple, by the way.
Hi.
For this.
Question shot.
Nice, there we go.
Yes, I think he deserves a shot.
You got a couple of regulators.
All right. So my question is sort of twofold. Around the office, we talk about this impedance mismatch between how a startup operates and what regulators look at. And this has impacts in terms of product innovation. So my first question is, how do you manage sort of the product innovation process when you know that that's operating at one sort of speed and regulation is operating at a different speed? And the second question, this is probably what I'm more curious about, is how do you manage that from a cultural perspective? You have a bunch of employees who've chosen to work at a startup, and they haven't chosen to work at a bank or a health insurance company or Hertz. How do you manage the fact that, you know, they have a lot of great ideas that you have to say no to or not quite yet? So those are my two parts of the question.
I'm going to ask Adam to take that.
I didn't hear the sort of lead into your question, but around the hiring part, let me just address that first. So we've been regulated since the beginning and participated in that regulatory process since the beginning. So I think people thought about us more as a kind of a financial services company in the earlier days, but we made it a priority to describe the vision to anybody that was coming in the door of, look, you know, we're aiming to delight the people that we serve, and there are regulations that sort of prevent us from doing that in the most efficient or best way. And we're going to prioritize our customers over those, and we're going to do everything that we can to, you know, keep operating, keep innovating along until, you know, those things change. And so it didn't become that big of a problem for us because everybody had the idea that we were kind of one foot in the regulated process, one foot outside from the beginning. And the people that, you know, kind of got too far on one side or the other, they left or they got fired. And so it wasn't, you know, that big of a deal at the end of the day. And then on the product development side of things, I think this is where really good and really, really awesome sort of compliance group and kind of internal general counsel can be really helpful, because if they're not called compliance officer and they're called like risk manager or something like that, something that makes it clear that their job is not to solely make you comply with what's existing, but to manage the risk that you're taking while going out and, you know, doing your business. I think they have a different mindset and they say, it's my job to get this done in the best way possible, or to, you know, advise that this is too risky. We have to have another strategy to changing this before we go down the road to doing this. It does sometimes, though, frustrate people, because not everybody in the company can understand the literally hundreds of thousands of pages of regulation that are out there. So they come up with an idea, they're really excited about it, and they think it's great, and then next thing you know, that violates 25102B or something like that. So we can't, you know, we have to go get that changed before we do it. I think we aim to be really responsive to people's ideas with our compliance and general counsel, and give them great feedback on, you know, what we're going to do to get it there, what we're going to do to get it to launch if it's kind of comes to the top of the priority. And that seems to kind of solve that kind of discontent that arises when, you know, you keep shooting down their ideas again and again.
Yeah. For us, we, along those lines, kind of keep it very simple and focused to a couple people. So in the past, we've had, you know, timelines slip because the regulation or a law or certain things weren't there yet. But at the same time, engineering stuff generally slips, so it seems to balance out. But we also, you know, try not to shoot down ideas, but we have so many ideas in general that we want to get done that we just try and pick the best ones and just get the bare minimum on compliance.
And for us, the way I think about hiring is quite simple. I want everyone at my company to be smarter than me, so that by the time I hit 20 people, I look around and couldn't possibly get a job at my own company. And if those are the kind of people that we hire, those are also the kind of people that do really well with these problem-solving things. And when you look at engineers and you look at the kinds of problems that they solve well, and then you look at regulation, which is a big mess of sort of conditional if statements, guess who's going to solve that and find the loopholes the fastest? It's not going to be me. And so we find that by sharing and having that conversation be as transparent in our company as possible, the best ideas bubble up because everyone is participating in figuring out how to hack the system and not being told no.
And I'm not going to answer that question because Josh already knows what we do.
Right. Although, just to frame it, we've just heard really conflicting answers, which I think is really good. We heard from Jessica, contain it to a small group of people. And we heard from Aza, spread it around the organization so everyone's working on their compliance problems. I don't know which is right. It may have something to do with the fields they're in, but next question.
Hi, my name is Katya. I'm originally Russian, so no tequila for me, sorry. So the question I have, I work for a financial company, which is a brokerage, and we're also regulated by CFTC and National Futures Association. And we do have, it's challenging for us to market the services for our clients. So the question for you is, how do you solve this problem? Because there are so many things you cannot say to your retail customers. So what do you do in this case? Thank you.
Feels like you again, Adam.
That's tough. We don't deal with retail customers, so that's our way of dealing with it.
But
that's one of the things.
Imagine a hypothetical world in which.
Yeah.
So, and do a shot for not thinking of that yourself.
Fine.
It might make you more creative.
Anybody got a lime? I think there's marketing of securities and then there's marketing of services, and the marketing of securities is governed by a completely separate kind of body of regulation. And so it's pretty straightforward that we follow, and it would apply whether or not the customer was retail. So let's talk about the marketing of services. There are all these rules around, how do you, this piece of sales collateral has to be reviewed by compliance before it's sent out. So, you're at a conference and you're hacking on your presentation and you have an idea, you want to change a little thing and you can't change it because it would have to go through a compliance infrastructure, get signed by 6 different people and then be done. So it's hard. You're right. I mean, it's tough to be flexible with that. We haven't done anything, so I can't share from experience, but we've optimized our process of reviewing those kinds of materials and the things that we would say to our customers, even though they're not retail customers, to be as efficient as possible. So we built custom software to manage our compliance process where people upload things that need to be approved. Notices are sent automatically out to the people that need to approve them. They can view them from any device that they're on, whether it's their iPad or their iPhone or wherever they are, and sign it. So that's a kind of simple, practical way of making the compliance process more efficient, but I don't have any experience in really dealing with that quagmire, so sorry.
Yeah, so we do deal with retail customers all the time, and I think that's probably sort of 3 approaches you can take to that problem. One is just ignore the law and just say what you think is right. And regulators are overstaffed and they are not following Twitter and Facebook and all the, so nobody might ever notice, right? It is risky though, right? The second sort of approach is to do the minimum you need to do to be compliant. And the best thing to do there is really to just start from what the law itself says rather than what everybody in the industry might have been doing for the last 70 years. So read the law, get some good lawyer or do it yourself, and then ask yourself, what do you need to do to comply? And you might very well find that you can do a lot within the framework of the law, but not within the framework of existing practice. The final thing to do is probably to separate out the different parts of your business. There may be some things which are heavily regulated and you cannot say, and there are some things where you can talk as much as you want because it's not regulated. So, you may not be able to say things about a bank account, but you may be able to say anything you want about an online banking experience.
Yeah. Right? If you're trying to build a consumer product and you think you can't do it because it's regulated, just do it anyway, because there's 2 reasons. So a lot of startups fail, so just see if you're going to get traction. So just see if people are going to start using it and people want it. And then secondly, a lot of the startups that are the most successful have actually done things and made billions of dollars in regulated industries and addressed it after the fact. So I'm actually creating a sharing consortium, for example, with some very successful sharing companies that they haven't done the lobbying that we have, and they're bigger than us, but now we have that to bring to the table. They have the scale to bring to the table. And so if real people are doing it, that's what matters to legislators and regulators, because you say, you know, 90% of the population in this city or in this area is doing this, you know, you are behind the times, adjust your whatever it is.
The canonical example of this is, of course, PayPal, who broke all sorts of interstate banking laws, but it didn't matter because they got big enough that they just changed it. So if you can get broad consumer demand, that's sort of your free get out of jail ticket.
I think we have time for one last question. So.
Great, I'll try to make it short. So related to the last point, it seems like there's some moments where there's regulators or other incumbents who are gatekeepers, and they make it, you can't enter the market without their blessing. It seems like some of the things you guys have hinted at is a show of force makes that entry easier. But there's a chicken and egg problem there in terms of if you're a startup, you probably don't have that much to show, but yet you can't do that until you pass through that gate. So I'm curious if there's any specific tactics you guys have used to sort of project that force that those gatekeepers tend to listen to.
Yeah.
Good question.
Take a shot.
Oh.
I think one really good tactic is actually getting a lot of good PR. So we've seen this work so well for us that if you can get New York Times, Wired, Wall Street Journal, and then all the top local publications, especially in DC or wherever government area you're trying to impact, if you get all these stories and just start sending them to their offices and they just get wind of it without you even proactively kind of pushing your agenda, that is actually a way to just prove your point, that you're, this press can show you as 1,000 times bigger than you really are, but it's the best kind of way that I know to get credibility.
Yeah, it's like being a cat. Just puff up your back. That's called PR. Make your hair stand up bend. And it works pretty well to gain attention and let you have that before you have the clout to change things. I don't know if that's worked with you guys.
Yes, completely. So I think we all need to do shots now.
I know. Bring your own first to the table.
We did manage everyone on the panel had a transgression, a shot-worthy transgression. So I think we've all done our duty. It's all optional from here on in. But we have come to the end of the hour. It's now 6 o'clock on a Friday night. So I think you all have some drinking to do. We will let you go. Thank you to the audience, and thank you to the panel.